Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk with Rob McClure and Erin Mackey. We also review The Bridges of Madison County, Lilium at Beautiful Soup Theater, The Other Josh Cohn at Paper Mill. Michael goes back to Disaster the Musical and The Glass Menagerie. We also talk about Maud Margart at the Cafe Carlyle and The American Showstoppers, an evening of Jerry Herman featuring the Fred Barton Orchestra. Please stay tuned.
What was I saying before about being lost? The thing is, I knew where I was, but not where I was going. Why did I walk those mountains? Why did I ride those ships? Why did I watch those horses running wild? Now I know. Now I know. All my life I have been falling. Have been falling into you, Francesca, circling in the sky, looking for a harbor, coming in.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, March 2nd, 2014. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Michael Portantier. Peter is off on assignment. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many other places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
So we do have a full schedule in front of us, so let's get right into it. With us this morning, our first guest is Rob McClure. We know Rob McClure from Chaplin, Honeymoon in Vegas, lots of different things that he's done. He's also got a film out right now called Recursion, which we're going to chat about. So good morning, Rob. Thanks for joining us on a Sunday morning.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
Are you coming to us from Virginia?
I'm from Philadelphia.
From Philadelphia?
That's right.
So are you at a film festival right now?
I'm not. No, we had the screening there last night, and our writer, Sam, our director, Sam Buntrock, and our writer, Stanton Nash, were down there, and they were keeping me updated the whole time.
Great. So we're talking about Recursion, which is a independent feature that is making the rounds in the festivals right now. Why don't you tell us about that?
It's kind of wild. It's a movie that Stanton Nash, who's actually, believe it or not, Erin Mackey's husband, Mackey, who played Una O'Neill in Chaplin, her husband wrote this crazy time travel short film. And Sam Buntrock of Sunday in the Park with George directing fame on Broadway, he was directing the film, and he, of course, saw Chaplin. Being a good friend of Stanton's, and then he basically called and said, "Hey, we've written this short film, and it's crazy and about time travel, and we hear you're a nerd. So does that seem like it would be of interest to you?" And of course it was, and we shot it very quickly this past summer, and now as you said, it's hitting all of the festivals and doing quite well. The Queen's World Film Festival that's in New York next week. It's been nominated for Best Short Film, Best Director, and I got nominated for Best Actor. So we're very excited.
Wow, the Queen's World Film Festival. I'm assuming it's in Queens.
That's right. Yes.
I could think of several films that would be eligible for that
That's
festival.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, so some of our local listeners might be able to check that out next weekend.
That would be great.
So tell us, your schedule has been very full over the last few months or so. How did you get in? You said it shot quickly during the summer. How quick is quickly?
Well, we did. I had two jobs at the Muni last summer. I was doing Lord Farquaad and Shrek, and then I was doing Bert and Mary Poppins. And I had a 2 week break in between. And they, when we talked about the film, I said I would love to do it, but those are the 2 weeks I can do it. And Sam Buntrock said, "Then we'll do it." So we crammed it in 2 weeks, and then when I got home from Mary Poppins afterward, we had a couple of little pickup shots to do. And then they cranked it out, but it was fast and furious.
And that was St. Louis Muni?
That's right. Yeah.
A small little venue there,
yes,
isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. It's a little intimate 13,000 seat house.
Not a bad seat in the house, they say.
That's right. Yes. Maybe for audio.
Yeah. And
don't they say not a good seat in the house?
Yes, yeah. Exactly, yeah. But it is the Muni is a trip. It's kind of amazing. It feels like a sporting event more than anything, because you know, you look out and you've got thousands of people with popcorn and sodas and hot dogs and all these things who come from far and wide to see these shows. And you know, doing Mary Poppins, there was something about sitting on top of the rooftops of the house set, watching Jenny Powers fly over 13,000 heads with the real moon behind her. That was very special.
Did you do the equivalent of the walking upside down?
You know, it's funny. The Muni has no proscenium, so there's no proscenium arch to tap on. But they came up with a great alternative, which was there were a bunch of different groups of chimney sweeps who were scattered across the stage on different rooftops, and I was rigged into a harness, and they would throw me with their hands from rooftop to rooftop, and I would go flying, you know, to 25 feet in the air and into the next group of chimney sweeps' hands on the next rooftop, so they would throw me from rooftop to rooftop. It was really fun.
That's great.
My wife is starting to joke that she knows which dressing room is mine because it's the one with a flying harness in it.
The St. Louis Muni is sort of a rite of passage of Broadway performers. It seems like everybody gets out there at one point or another.
Yeah, because it's so quick. You know, it's 9 days of rehearsal and anywhere between 7 and 9 performances. So you're there for maybe 2.5 weeks from first rehearsal to last performance. So it's a fun, quick way to go play. And they usually get their hands on a bunch of really good artists. So it's fun.
So you performed out there July 25th to August 2nd. Did you have any fun heat or rain events?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you sort of that's part of the rite of passage.
Yeah.
They have something, you know, for people who don't know their process, you know, this past summer, they closed South Pacific on a Sunday and opened Les Mis on a Monday.
Incredible.
It's really astounding how they churn it out there. And it's partly because they do one night of tech rehearsals, and it's from midnight to 5 a.m. the night before you open, because not a lot of people think about it, but you can't tech lights during the day if it's outside.
Yes.
So you tech lights from midnight to 5 a.m., then you go home and you sleep, and you have your sits probe at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you open that night.
Incredible.
So you did Mary Poppins. What else did you do?
Shrek, and I did Lord Farquaad and Shrek on my knees.
So Shrek was June 24th to the 30th. So you were out there, then you left, and you came back.
Yes, and I came back and did the crazy movie, and then went right back for Mary Poppins.
And so, all in the midst of this, forgive me if I have the sequence out of order. Did Honeymoon in Vegas came after that, right?
Right after it, yeah. And Honeymoon in Vegas was something that I had auditioned for before Chaplin. It was a long, long time ago. Honeymoon in Vegas was supposed to have an opening in Toronto.
Sure. Yeah.
And for whatever reason, that fell through. And I was when I first was doing Chaplin, I was very excited about Chaplin, obviously. But I did have a connection to that material when I auditioned. So knowing that I was proceeding with Chaplin and sort of letting Honeymoon go because Chaplin was as exciting as it was for me, was sad because I really did love the material. And then for whatever reason, that Toronto production fell through. And then the next time I heard about it, Chaplin was over. and I was available, which I was so excited about because I had loved it so much. And that came along right after that summer at the Muni, and then I returned to the Paper Mill to premiere Honeymoon in Vegas, which, and the Paper Mill is like a bit of a second home to me.
I was at a Paper Mill last night at the other Josh Cohn. Tell us about your. Have you done other shows at Paper Mill?
I have. I owe them big time. So I was doing shows in high school. You know, I didn't know I was good at this. It was another extracurricular thing. I was going to do the bowling team in the winter and the play. Something else to do. And the Paper Mill has this extraordinary program called the Rising Star Awards, where they send, you know, four judges to almost every high school musical in the state of New Jersey. And then they do sort of a high school Tony Awards. And my senior year of high school, I had done Where's Charlie, which I got to do again at Encores a few years ago. And they came and I won the Rising Star Award. And it was the first time I ever sort of thought, well, gosh, maybe I'm good at this. And they gave me a scholarship to their summer theater conservatory, which was sort of my first professional training. And then they cast me in the chorus of their production of Carousel back in 2001. And that was my first professional job. Later, after that, I got a job working in their box office, which was a genius idea because I thought, you know, working in the box office will really gain me credibility with them as an actor. It achieved the complete opposite. Instead, I was going into auditions and they would go, oh, it's the kid from the box office. It's an actor. Tragic. But out of that, they were doing a production of I'm Not Rappaport with Judd Hirsch and Ben Vereen. And it was a co-production with a couple of other theaters. And I auditioned for it and I didn't get it. It went to the other theaters in the co-production. And right before it got to New Jersey, the kid who was understudying the part that I had gone in for wasn't from New Jersey. He was from one of the other theaters and didn't want to do it anymore. So he stopped. And they asked me, hey, do you want to understudy the role you auditioned for? And I, being non-equity at the time, was making more in the box office than I would have understudying in the show. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I don't want to lose the money from the box office. Can I understudy? And if I'll be in the box office, and if you need me, I'll give you my phone extension. You can call me. I'll come back with the costume on and do it. And me. So I was understudying I'm Not Rappaport from the box office. And the Roy Miller came into the box office and said, hey, the show is going to Broadway and we're bringing everyone and here's your equity card. And 2 months later, I was in a Broadway play at the Booth Theater with a dressing room on Schubert Alley and had no idea how the hell I had gotten there. I really do owe Paper Mill a huge amount for giving me several big breaks.
A friend of mine, Rob, has been or was a judge for the Rising Star Awards. And I mentioned, I saw her not long ago and I mentioned, oh, didn't Anne Hathaway come through that? And she kind of looked embarrassed and said, we didn't pick her.
Yeah, she was nominated, but she didn't win.
Well, Rob, I mean, you know, that's a typical trail to go from the box office to Broadway, right? So.
So
tell us about Chaplin. You know, during Chaplin, we were all fans here. We were trying to get you on Broadway Radio, but your schedule really didn't allow it. So we want to go back in time to Chaplin and tell us about your experience there.
My gosh. It was life-changing. It really was. My great aunt Marion, my entire life told me that I looked like Charlie Chaplin, but that was kind of the extent of my knowledge of him before. I knew the image and I knew that he was funny, but that's really what I knew going into the audition process. And it's so funny. I was doing a show at the American Repertory Theater at the time up in Boston, taking the Amtrak back every Monday for another callback and another callback for this show. And finally, I was on the Amtrak train from Boston to my final callback. And my Aunt Teresa, who was my Aunt Marion's daughter, my Aunt Marion had since passed probably a year before that audition as it had even happened. She called me while I was on the train and said, hey, we were going through Mom's stuff. And I came across a 6-foot portrait she painted of Charlie Chaplin in 1979. Do you want it? And I said, I'm on my way to a final callback for a Broadway show to play Charlie Chaplin. And she sort of jokingly said, well, if you get it, you have to hang it in your dressing room. And I did, and I proudly hung it in my dressing room and now in my house. It was kind of a strange kismet, but the audition process was terrifying. That final callback on that Monday, well, so I thought it was my final callback. I sang through all the material from the show, and they said, okay, tomorrow before you head back to Boston, come back at 10 and have a 2-minute chaplain-y thing ready. And I didn't know what the heck that meant. So I went home and panicked and sort of racked my brain for what a 2-minute chaplain-y thing might be. my wife, smart, she's an actress as well, named Maggie Lakis. And she said, well, why don't you at least bring music in the room so you're not hung out to dry with the silence of the room? And I thought, okay, that's a good idea. So I looked through the classical music list on my phone, and I had Flight of the Bumblebee. And I was listening to the, and I thought, I'm going to bring a fly swatter and that song and fight an invisible fly and lose. And I said, that's it. And I fell asleep. And I woke up the next morning, got on the Amtrak train with a fly swatter in my headphones. I'm sure everyone on the train thought I was out of my mind swatting at things. coming up with what this bit was going to be on the way to New York. And the first time I had done it full out was on my feet in the room. And I guess it went well. And I got cast to do it out at the La Jolla Playhouse when it was known as Limelight at the time. And we did a run out there, and then we took about 6 months off. We did a developmental reading at the Alvin Ailey Studios in New York, and then we had got the news that we had gotten the Booth Theater on Broadway, and it changed my life. You know, that Chaplin's aesthetic and his story is one that resonated so deeply with me, and not just with me, because it was the first time I had done a show where there were always several dozen people at the stage door in tears. He meant so much to so many people that to be able to share the passion for that with so many people was really profoundly moving for me.
Rob, I don't remember. Did Geraldine Chaplin ever get to see the show?
She didn't, but Chaplin's granddaughter, Kiera, and her family came to see it when we were out. Oh, yeah, and then again on Broadway. And perhaps the greatest gift I received during the my time with the show was an email that she saw the show on a Friday. And on Monday, the composer, Chris Curtis, forwarded me an email that he had received from her saying, we love the show. At the end of the show, you guys project a clip of Chaplin walking off into the sunset, as a final image. We've been racking our brains all weekend trying to find that footage. Which movie is it from? And it was me. We filmed it on a field in La Jolla. And the idea that for even a moment that they would have mistaken me for him. I got the email at 3 o'clock in the morning and cried like an idiot for a half an hour.
Wow. So we don't want you to say anything you're not allowed to say or talk out of school, but tell us, what's the scoop on Honeymoon? Is it coming in?
Honeymoon is happening. It's just a question of the right theater. Every time I talk to the producers, they assure me that it is 100% happening. And every time I talk to Tony Dent, he is chomping at the bit to get back to it. So it is happening. It's just a question of exactly when. Right now they're saying it's definitely 2014. They don't know exactly when in 2014, but I'm so excited to get back to it. And, they're trying to be smart, and just make sure that we get it in the right house, because, the reviews at Paper Mill were so astoundingly great, that they're just trying to, not screw this up, because they've done everything right so far.
Good job. You dropped out for a second there. Anytime you talk to Tony who?
Danza.
To Tony Danza.
Oh, Tony Danza. Yeah. Yes. That was such a great show, Rob. It was amazing. I couldn't believe it. As I said at the time to, I think, Peter and James, you see a show like that and you think, oh, it's so easy to write a musical, because it's so effortless and so fun. And then you see the next show and you think, oh, God, this is really hard to write this kind of stuff. So I can't wait to see it again.
Yeah, I can't wait to jump back in. And Jason Robert Brown, I really do think that's one of the best musical comedy scores I've heard in a long time.
Absolutely.
It's just so funny. And there's something about his combination of sort of the Rat Pack Vegas big band style that feels like a throwback. And yet his lyrics are so contemporary and so right now and so funny. You know, so many people associate Jason Robert Brown with Parade and Dark. And he is a funny guy.
I have a friend who has not been a great fan just because he doesn't necessarily like those darker types of musicals. And I said, well, you are going to love this one because it sounds like Golden Rainbow.
Yes, it really does. And, there's just something about, he's given me this incredible, opening number called I Love Betsy. And it's sort of a bossa nova Vegas opening, but with lyrics like, just like Jay-Z and Beyonce, I will make her my fiance. I love that. it was such a thrill to get to perform them. And, you know, we're doing a 54 Below concert of Honeymoon in Vegas that they're entitling While We're Waiting. we're going to perform most of the score on April 7th at 54 Below.
Oh, that's great. Wow.
So, Rob, we have somebody on the line with us who you may know, this woman named Erin Mackey. Do you know who she is?
Unfortunately, she's like the opposite of a ray of sunshine. I can't believe you're putting me through this.
Oh, the black hole.
Hello.
Oh, there she is.
Oh, I adore her more than anything.
Hi, Robbie.
Hi, love. She is perhaps one of the most delightful people to work with and play with I have ever met.
So, you're so nice.
I have to lie. It's the radio.
I know. You're being extra nice.
So it was a happy marriage off stage, if not always on.
It was.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, we had so much fun working together.
And Erin,
wonderful.
Erin had a rough job because, she had to come in very late in the show.
Right. It was really rough.
Yeah. Well, I don't know many actresses who could enter a show that late in the game and still, you know, if you're halfway through Act Two and we haven't met you yet, I worried that the audience would be like, oh, there are so many characters that we care about so far, and you're introducing yet another one. Mm-hmm. And they instantly fell in love with her. It's such a welcome breath of fresh air for Charlie and for the audience. It was, I don't know many
yeah,
people.
Yeah, I think people were ready for that in the show. You know, people were like ready for something good to happen to Charlie. When she came out, everyone was like, oh, yay!
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we should formally say that we're talking about Chaplin. Erin,
yes.
Was in, because we didn't say that. that Erin was in Chaplin, and as mentioned, she could have played Fantine in Act 1 of Les Mis and come over to Chaplin and done Act 2.
That's right.
pretty much. But Michael and I were scheduling people, and we actually double scheduled for today. But it turned out that we were going to talk to Erin because of the upcoming Sweeney Todd.
And I absolutely did not make the connection to you know, it didn't occur to me until James said it. And I was like, oh, well, that works out.
Yeah, I was like, hey, I stalked both of those people. Wait, no. So, it turned out to a little kismet, but we're going to say goodbye to Rob now. Thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning, Rob. You have a great festival next week in Queens.
Thank you so much. Erin's husband will be there with me.
Oh, yeah, that's my husband. He wrote and produced or helped produce that film and did all the sound.
Okay, well, it's not like it's a small business with only 10 people in it.
Yeah, so the kismet continues.
Right.
All right, Rob. Well, you have a great one. We're going to talk with Erin about Sweeney Todd. All right.
Thanks. I'm jealous. I can't wait to listen in.
Great. Have a good one.
Thanks.
We'll
Bye-bye.
Speak to you
Hi,
soon.
Robbie.
Bye-bye. So Erin Mackey has joined us, and we know Erin from Wicked, Sondheim on Sondheim, Anything Goes, and Chaplin, as we just talked about, and the upcoming production of Sweeney Todd. So Erin, thank you for joining us on a Sunday morning.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, are you in the midst of deep rehearsals?
Oh, yeah, we're really, really in it. Tomorrow we start tech. So we've had, I actually just joined this week for rehearsals, but they had rehearsed for a week prior to that. Kind of people have sort of been in and out, you know, with scheduling and stuff. But yeah, I spent this whole week rehearsing, you know, every day, and now we start tech tomorrow.
We should say that Erin is playing Joanna in Sweeney Todd. Erin, some of these productions, that these stage concerts that the Philharmonic has done with Lonnie Price directing, I think they've, it's fair to say they've gotten more elaborate in terms of staging and even props and costumes and even set pieces sometime. So can you talk a little bit about what we can expect in those terms? And I should mention that that Lonnie Price already had directed Sweeney Todd for the Philharmonic some years ago with Patti LuPone and George Hearn.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering just in general what we can expect in terms of staging and props and costumes and sets or any, you know, anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I actually probably, unfortunately, can't talk about this too much just because we are trying to kind of keep it, you know,
A
little under wraps. But it's, you know, it's fairly straightforward, this one. You know, it's, we're trying to kind of keep it a little simpler. But there, you know, there is some zhuzhing happening to the stage, and the Philharmonic will be with us on stage. But you know, costumes kind of, or clothing sort of hinting at who we are in the show. Lonnie came up with some really cool ideas, but I wish I could talk about it a little bit more, but I'm going to kind of...
We'll wait and see.
Well, it's just right around the corner.
So everyone will see it, yes.
Oh, is it definitely planned for, they've done some of them as cinecasts in theaters. Is that the plan for this one?
Yes, it is. It is. We're filming the show a couple nights, and the plan is to broadcast it. I think it's a PBS thing, but not totally sure. I think so.
Well, what happened with the Company, for example, is first they showed it in movie theaters as a cinecast, you know, and then
right.
Later I believe it was on PBS. I think that's what.
I'm not sure about the movie theater thing, but I think PBS is happening.
Right.
At least. Yeah.
So, Erin, let's step back from Sweeney for a second and talk a little bit about Wicked. Rob was telling me how he got his Equity card because he was in the box office at the paper mill and got pulled into a Broadway production, which is totally normal. It happens all the time. So you were a freshman in college and you got the national tour of Wicked? Is that
how that happened? Well, you know, I had worked as a kid, so you know, kind of the professional entertainment industry wasn't completely new to me. I started auditioning for film and television when I was about 11 years old. I grew up in Orange County, California, so I was close to LA. So I kind of did the film TV thing, but I always loved theater and I studied voice, and so, you know, I did whatever theater things were around. So by the time I got to college, you know, I had an agent, I had a manager. I had a little help, you know, getting that audition for Wicked. So, I went to school at Carnegie Mellon. I had my whole first year there. And then when I came back on my summer break, I found out that they were holding auditions for Wicked in LA. So I called to get an appointment and they said that they would see me. I'd known the Telsey casting office a little bit. So I wanted to go to my appointment, but I was doing another show at the time. I was doing Babes in Arms. So I couldn't go to my appointment. So I went to the open call. And since I was non-equity, I like had to sit around all day. So I sat around. And then when I finally got to go in the room, the casting director, Craig Burns, was like, wait, don't you have an appointment? And so he let me have like my whole audition, even though everyone else was like having to do 8 bars, you know, so he was being very kind at the end of his long day. Let me have my full audition. And then I had a call back and I was cast as a swing on the tour.
So swinging is a really difficult job, especially if it's your first major production. Tell us what that was like to, you know, and when was your first opportunity to go on?
Swinging, I actually really enjoyed swinging. I have a really photographic memory. So for me, it was like stage pictures was like how I kind of did my swinging and numbers, the numbers on the stage. But I actually found it really fun. The hardest part for me was the fact that sometimes you can go long periods of time without going on, you know, if people are healthy and not sick. So that was the hardest part for me was swinging. My first time on was I joined the tour in San Francisco. They decided that they needed an extra female swing because the girls were, there were some injuries. And so, so I got up there and I was supposed to go on like after 2 weeks of rehearsal, I think. And of course, after 1 week, they were down some girls. So, so I ended up having to go on after a week of rehearsal where I had kind of been rehearsing a different person's part. And so with, I think like in a day or two, I had to learn this part that I went on for. So my first part was for the woman who plays the midwife in the beginning. So I like, my big entrance was as like an antelope with a mask on my face and like little paws and stuff. And my parents were there and my mom started crying. I was like, Mom, I'm dressed like an antelope. And you're crying, but that's really sweet. So it was like my big moment.
How about your first time in the bubble?
Oh yeah. I started as an understudy for Glinda, in the Chicago company. So my first time on, the first time I was scheduled to go on, that I was supposed to go on for a whole weekend. I was going to get four shows. And I think it was like, I was supposed to go on Friday and on Tuesday, I sprained my ankle and I was out of the show for 2 months, which was so horrible. I was so devastated. And I was like, I had just gotten to the company and like, I was so excited I was going to get to go on. And then I sprained my ankle. So, I was out for 2 months, and then when I came back, I think just a couple weeks after I had come back, Stacey Morgan Lewis was playing Glinda, and she called out of the show, and so I think I found out just like that morning, you know, it was like a Saturday morning that I was going to go on to the matinee. It's a complete whirlwind, but also our associate director, Lisa Leguio, just happened to be in town and was there and saw my first performance. So it was kind of great that she was there for the first performance because there was sort of nothing to lose because it was my first time on, you know, like it was almost not nerve wracking to have her there because it was like, well, it's just going to be whatever it is because I just need to like not screw up and not like mess people up. I just remember it being a complete blur. Pretty much.
Well, you know, and then Wicked has become this enormous
juggernaut.
Giant, for, you know, you know, around the world, where you know you're rivaling the Lion Kings and the Phantoms and the Les Mis's around the world for at least alumni in the show. Everybody has at one point or another been in it, so you must be seeing a lot of your friends at later productions.
Constantly. Oh my gosh. Well, and now, you know, and now because it's been around for enough years, there's enough people who have done it that it's starting to just now, like within the past couple of years, get to the point where someone's like, oh, so-and-so from Wicked. And I'll be like, oh man, I've been out of it just long enough that I actually don't know that person. But like, you know, all the names, you know. Actually, even in Sweeney Todd right now, we have Michael Seelbach and Ashley Robinson, who I did Wicked with in Chicago. Mm. So I see them everywhere. I married one. I'm married to my Bach from Chicago.
You know, it's a whole, you could have a whole Wicked dating site then, you know.
I know. There's been a lot of couples.
So tell us a little bit more about Sweeney. You have quite the cast in Sweeney.
It's incredible.
You have Philip Quast. You have J. Armstrong Johnson. So
somebody named Emma Thompson, I think.
I wasn't going to mention her because I've never heard of her before. So, right. So tell
Bryn
us.
Bryn Terfel, just, you know. A moderately famous opera star. Mm-hmm.
Jay and Philip are sort of notorious characters. Are they playing jokes on you?
Oh, not too badly yet. Maybe because I'm still kind of a newbie to the room.
Okay.
Maybe you have something to look forward to.
I know. Now I need to. I don't mind.
Keep an eye open for them.
That makes me laugh. Okay. You know, Good to know.
And that accent Philip has, it's fake. He's from New Jersey.
Right.
Yeah. So, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning and getting up a little bit early, especially you're in your crunch time right now. And I know that Michael's going to come back and give us a full report, so you better be good.
Oh, all right. I'll do my best.
Alrighty. All right. You have a great day.
Thanks for talking.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Whatever we do from here, don't give it a name. We mustn't reduce it to something clear or simple. I want to believe that we are the first people on earth to know this feeling, to know this moment, to cross this line.
Adding up all those minutes, staring through all I saw, how could I know the answer would be?
How could I know the answer?
Only
it was a lot of fun to have both Rob and Aaron on, Michael. It was kismet that we were able to schedule them at the same time.
Yes.
So,
as you say, it's it can seem like an incredibly small world in the theater industry sometimes.
Absolutely. I don't know if you go through this, Michael, but we go through cycles. I go through cycles where I see a whole bunch of really great shows all at once, and then I go through cycles where you see a lot of like things like, oh, this was a terrible waste of my time. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, right now, I'm going through this cycle of seeing excellent, excellent shows right now.
That's good.
And one of them that I saw was on Wednesday night. I saw The Bridges of Madison County, and I saw that you were there a couple of rows in front of me as well. So why don't you start us off and tell us what you thought about Bridges?
Well, let me start by saying that Jason Robert Brown, who we were just discussing for his great score for Honeymoon in Vegas, has written an equally great score for The Bridges of Madison County, but so different that you would never believe it was the same person. And to me, as I think I've said before, I think that's one of the marks of true genius. If you can have a composer who can do that and really adapt his style and his musical language from one property to the next, according to what's best for the property, I think that's the mark of a truly great composer. There are several others who have done it. One that leaps immediately to mind is Cy Coleman, who really was one of the absolute greats, and I think Jason is right up there with him. It's an incredible versatility that he has. That said, I as far as this show on the whole, I thought it didn't really work. They have made the decision in the adaptation, Jason and Marcia Norman, the book writer, to spend a lot of time on the other characters other than the two central lovers, specifically and most importantly on Francesca's family, her husband and her two children. But then there's a lot of time with the townspeople. There's a number sung by in sort of a flashback kind of thing by Robert's ex-wife. who I don't even remember. I saw the movie a long time ago. I'm going to really have to go back to it and see how much time is spent with those other characters. My memory is not nearly as much. And I think while I completely understand why they did it, James, I just don't think it was necessarily the best idea to focus so much on those other characters in this piece. And I had a really intriguing idea in retrospect. I think what they should have done, and this would have been incredibly unusual, but I think this would have really been great if they had included all of those characters, except maybe the ex-wife, and given them a lot of lines to say, but not musicalized them at all, and left the singing only to Francesca and Robert. I think that might have been a really bold way to do it, and a way to also give us an idea of the community and the other people affected by their love affair and the chance that she's going to run off with him without just spending all that time on them. So I think if I, you know, could rewrite this show, what I would do is I would cut out all of those songs involving the other characters, maybe cut out one or two of the numbers, you know, involving Francesca and Robert, and do it all as a one act. And I think I don't know for sure that that would have worked, but I suspect it might have worked better. And as I say, it would have been an incredibly, incredibly odd way to do it. But I think I like that idea of playing with in musicals, having characters who don't sing for specific reasons. And in this case, it would have been, you know, the idea being that Francesca and Robert are kind of in their own romantic world that sets them apart from everyone else. And I think that might have been a really, really, really interesting way to do it.
So I know what you're saying, and and my wife said the same thing about the other characters having full songs, but I really liked it.
I mean it and the songs themselves, I hasten to say, are all excellent. It's just I don't know. I could see it either way. And as I said, I totally understand why they did it. I'm sure they said to themselves, well, we can't just have these two, you know, we can't have just them for the whole 2.5 hours. But I personally, to be more accurate, I felt sometimes I felt it sort of worked, and then many other times I felt it didn't.
So, one of the things that was interesting that I was thinking about this a lot was that the folks who were in the ensemble that had these songs, these were people who were principal performers in large Broadway shows themselves. So they were, each one of them, you know, you have your Hunter Fosters and Michael X. Martins, Cass Morgan. These are folks who were extraordinarily talented people. I wonder if Jason wrote them songs just because they were in the production and they are so talented. And what do you think?
Oh, well, I wouldn't think so, because I would think he would have, you know, his conception in mind, he and Marsha Norman, and that they would, you know, keep mm-hmm. to the integrity of that. But I see what you're saying. Certainly the ex-wife could easily have been eliminated entirely.
I agree with that. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I also hasten to say, I think this is one of the best performances I've ever seen Hunter Foster give.
Yeah.
It could be a very, it is a very difficult role of the husband who, he's kind of a, you know, he's a very simple character. He's no Einstein, you know, but he's a very good man. He has a somewhat troubled relationship with the children, so that complicates it further. And he really could come across as a, you know, just really an annoying and needless presence. But I thought he really brought a lot to the role.
So, I was so like blown away, for the 24 hours after I saw the show. I really, I thought that the performances that, Stephen Pasquale and Kelly O'Hara gave were just, certainly, puts them right in the lead for nominations of Tony Awards, really, really phenomenal, outstanding performances. I'm interested to see how this stacks up against the rest of what's happening this season. I think that
they really are both so extraordinary. I mean, I don't hesitate in saying probably two of the greatest voices ever heard on Broadway. And on top of that, acting ability, you know, that's the equal of the greatest non-musical actors, if not even better. And both, you know, both so beautiful to look at. So what don't they have, these two? It's amazing. And Kelly, you know, she, aside from everything else, she's also seems to be really excellent at dialects. I remember seeing her do My Fair Lady some years ago, and I was, you know, before I saw it, I was wondering, oh, you know, that's really tough with the Cockney and then the upper class Brit. Is she going to be able to do that? And to me, she sounded, you know, just absolutely perfect. And here, her Italian accent, you know, I mean, I have some experience with Italian accents and certainly sounded right to me. I will say, I don't think she looked like any Italian woman that I've ever known.
Nor than Italian.
Okay. Well, yeah. And that despite the change in hair color. But really what an amazing voice. And Stephen, I think I mentioned this before. It's really almost criminal that he has not been available to do more musical theater work for several years because he was tied up with the TV show Rescue Me. But that is finally over, and and I hope he makes up for lost time. It seems like he's really planning on doing that, because in a very short period of time, both he and Kelly went from Far From Heaven to this show. Stephen also, I mean, he's done like concerts, you know, like little one night benefit things. A lot of those over the years. He did a little Night Music, and he did a Secret Garden that I'll never forget. He's just extraordinary. The two of them are it just does not get better than those two.
So let's change some gears here and leave Bridges of Madison County until next week, when we can get Peter's take on it. And you saw Lilium at Beautiful Soup. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, this is Lilium by, I've never been quite sure how to pronounce his name, but it's Ferenc Molnár, the Hungarian playwright. Lilium, the original play upon which Carousel is based. And I think it's fair to say very rarely performed these days. One of those plays that has been almost completely supplanted by the musical version. Another one is They Knew What They Wanted by Sidney Howard, which became The Most Happy Fella. And and of course, Green Grow the Lilacs, which became Oklahoma. I mean, when has anyone done Green Grow the Lilacs? Wouldn't be great to see that, wouldn't it? Yes, Lilium done by Beautiful Soup. I should say, at the start, I mean, I'm not completely sure if they were 100% faithful to the original text, but I it seemed like they were. This is as translated by Benjamin Glazer many, many years ago, and performed on Broadway and elsewhere, but really a really, really, really long time ago. The thing that struck me most is how much of it was very, very close to Carousel. In some sections, I would say almost word for word with the dialogue. There are some kind of major differences. In this one, Mr. Snow equivalent is not a fisherman. He's kind of a bellhop or something who works in a hotel. The Nettie Fowler character is quite different. She's much less sympathetic to Billy. She's much harsher on him, to the Billy Bigelow equivalent, who is Lilium. That's what he's called. That's his nickname. There was a really interesting scene in, I guess, Purgatory, you'd call it, where Lilium and two other men are sort of being called, you know, to account for themselves. And we see, you know, what their fate is going to be, you know, whether they have to stay in purgatory for an unspecified amount of time, you know, before they move on to heaven, or whether they get sent to hell, or whatever happens to them. So that was a really intriguing scene, but much of it was very, very similar. And it was, you know, quite a simple, bare bones production, not a lot in terms of sets and costumes and stuff, but it was extraordinary just to get to see the play. And there were, I should note the performance of Gerard Lobo as Lilium, because aside from his acting, I mean, he had really quite a strong presence, but he is, I don't know what his ethnicity is, but to me, he looked like he might almost be Indian or something like that, or he might be a mix. The point is, he looked very different in terms of ethnicity from the bulk of the characters, and that also served to set Lilium apart from the community, because he is supposed to be an outsider. So that was an intriguing bit of, I guess, non-traditional casting. And I noticed today, I didn't realize this beforehand, or I might have tried to go to the Sunday performance matinee instead of the night I attended, but they're having Wayne Blood from the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization at a talk back after the performance today, as we're recording. And then also a Molnar scholar is going to be there, and I assume several of the cast members. So I would have really loved to be there for that discussion of the adaptation and, you know, various little stories about that.
Well, Beautiful Soup, we've talked about them a few times on this broadcast before. They're down at a theater called the Celebration of Whimsy Theater on Clinton Street, 21 Clinton Street, and these performances are going on through March 9th. We'll have a link in the show notes about this if you want more information about it, but certainly you don't get a chance to see Lilium very often.
So. No, you really don't, and I really recommend it for that reason, but also that they, you know, they did, I would say the acting is variable and blah, 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 but they overall did quite a good job with it. And it was, I would also say it was quite well directed.
And did you mention Stephen Carl?
Stephen Carl McCasland.
McCasland.
Well, actually the credit. Yeah. This is why I gave that disclaimer about, I'm not sure 100% how accurate it is to what was done on Broadway, because it reads written by Ferenc Molnar, translated by Benjamin Glazer, adapted by Stephen Carl McCasland. Now, of course, it was a translation to begin with, so maybe that gives an adapter, you know, a director, a little more leeway to not necessarily keep every line exactly the way it was. Many of the lines were very, very similar to what I know, you know, to be the script from Carousel. So maybe there was some adjustments in like colloquialisms and things like that. But I am going to have to get hold of a script of Lilium, and that shouldn't be too hard to do.
All right. So moving forward, I saw the other Josh Cohn last night at Paper Mill, and you guys spoke about it last week. I just wanted to weigh in and say that I had a wonderful time at it, and that I'd be surprised if it transferred to Broadway and became a hit. I really see it more as an off-Broadway show. Of not enough quality to be a Broadway show. Certainly it is, but I sort of feel like it was like the other half of a First Date, the musical that just closed on Broadway a few months ago, that it's in that same realm and genre. And I think that I think the other Josh Cohn would tour really well around the United States. I think it's going to play in a lot of good regional theaters and make be a standard fare in many places, and it's a really good show. I'm just not sure that they can sell it as a Broadway show, but we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see. I mean, I'm not even sure what Broadway means anymore in terms of what works and what doesn't work on Broadway. There have been several things that I would have thought would not work on Broadway that did, and vice versa. But I certainly understand your point. And again, it's not a question of quality at all. It just has a sort of off-Broadway feel in terms of the type of humor and the intimacy of it and other
well,
things.
Well, I think you hit upon that right, exactly right. I think even at, you know, I was sitting 10th row center at Paper Mill, and it was really good for me. I can't imagine that people sitting in that large house there in the back got the same experience that I had, which is why I don't think it would work on Broadway very well, which is probably why I felt First Date didn't work as well. If you were, you know, in the first 10 or 15 rows in First Date, it was great. And I got that enjoyment out of it. Then I spoke to folks who didn't sit in those 10 or 15 rows, and it was problematic. And that's why I think even Paper Mill, the house is too big for it. But
on the other hand, I mean, it's quite a loud show. It's amplified, you know, rockish music, rock music, I would say. And also it's not very subtle in terms of the humor. I mean, it's pretty broad humor. I'll never forget how many people I heard insisting that Avenue Q would not work on Broadway. People have different ideas, I guess, of exactly what projects to that size house. And you really can't tell until it happens. So I completely understand what you're saying, but maybe not. We'll see.
Yeah, the size of the house is, I guess, maybe more of a directorial challenge, but. You know, as I mentioned before, I saw Honeymoon Vegas in nearly the same seats that I saw the other Josh Cohn, but I could understand every word that was happening in Honeymoon in Vegas, and I really was having problems hearing. It was a loud show, so certainly we hear that, but I wasn't hearing all the lyrics, which, you know, when I did catch them, they were very, very clever and very smart, and so. I wonder if the sound design, you don't think about how the sound design can help a show, but maybe sound design could have helped another Josh Cohn.
I noticed that as well. I think that the sound at Paper Mill has always been variable. I don't know if they always use the same people. And I wouldn't say I had a big problem with it, but there were times when it seemed distorted and I couldn't quite always figure out what they were saying. But again, you know, I mean, there are Broadway theaters, at least a couple of them, that are much smaller than Paper Mill.
Sure.
So it might, in that sense, you know, if they get one of those.
And yeah, if they put it in the haze, absolutely. Yeah,
and if they tweak the sound design, as you said, because it would be a shame to miss any of the lyrics, because they're really very funny and clever.
And the last thing before we move on off of the other Josh Cohn is that, again, we have another show where these actors are singing, dancing, acting, and playing instruments. This seems to be a theme that has come up a bunch of times in the last couple of months. So, if you're thinking about becoming an actor, take up an instrument as well, because
it couldn't hurt.
It couldn't hurt. And we were talking in the Bridges of Madison County, the ex-wife, is a character who plays a guitar on stage, but she really didn't play guitar during that song. And it was really distracting if she actually wasn't going to play the guitar, why they had her put the guitar in her hands. Did you notice that?
I guess I sort of did, but I wasn't focusing on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I know what you mean.
So you went back to Disaster again. Tell us about why you went back.
Oh, I went back to Disaster because it was, the pretext for going back was that it was gay night. Which, as I've been joking to people, you know, gay night at Disaster is kind of like straight night at Rocky, or African American night at A Raisin in the Sun. I mean, certain shows seem to largely attract certain types of audiences, and Disaster is so much fun and so campy. But on the other hand, you know, I don't mean to imply that 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 it's only of interest to gay people, not by any means, because all of the songs in Disaster, like the 50 hit songs of the 70s primarily, and maybe the 80s a little bit, that they use in the show, they were all, you know, they were all top 40 hits, you know, and obviously, so obviously it wasn't only gay people who loved them. The show remains as delightful and hilarious as it was the first two times I saw it. And almost all of the cast has changed. Very few people remain, but Matt Farcher, I should mention him. He remains as the male lead, the male romantic lead. And he has such an amazing voice. And Seth, of course, Seth Rudetsky, the co-author, is still in it as the geologist who's predicting disaster for this floating casino that's docked in the Hudson because it's been docked over a fault line. It's ridiculous, ridiculous plot, but so funny. Judy Gold is now in the sort of Shelley Winters Poseidon Adventure role that was created by Mary Testa, or at least played by her in this production when it opened. And let's see. Max Crumb from Greece is now in it. In the role previously played by Rob Sapp, and he was great. They had various celebrities at this performance to which was a benefit, I believe. And they had among them John Tartaglia was there, and also Norbert Leo Butz, who, as far as I know, is not gay, but certainly gay friendly. And I got a chance to speak with him briefly about the Big Fish recording, which has come out recently. And I asked him if he was happy with it, and he said he just was really thrilled, and he thought they did a really great job of it. I did want to mention that has come out on Broadway Records. Also, we've had recently Janice, A Night with Janis Joplin on Broadway Records. And we have a DVD from Broadway Records called From Broadway with Love, a benefit concert for Sandy Hook, with a lot of, let's see, on January 28th, 2013, nearly 500 performers came together in a concert of healing for the Sandy Hook Newtown community, featuring, and then I can't, I'll just name a few names: Nikki Blonsky, Philip Boykin, Michael Cerveris, Robin DeJesus, Mickey Dolenz, Christine Ebersole, Mark Shaman, Stephen Schwartz, Julia Murney, Brian Stokes Mitchell, and more than a dozen others. So that's something that you might really want to pick up. And then I've been meaning to mention this for several weeks. Something extraordinary came out from Masterworks, Sony Columbia Masterworks, the original cast recording of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is not a musical. But in those days, there were several, I believe, recordings made of original casts of straight plays on Broadway. And thank God they did this one, because, I mean, it's achieved legendary status. Uta Hagen, Arthur Hill, George Grizzard, directed by Alan Schneider. It's just, you know, I mean, in a way, it's almost better. In a way, it's almost better than having a video, because the performances, the vocal performances that you hear on the recording are so vivid that you really feel like you're watching the play, despite the lack of the visual component. So I would really, really pick this up if you care about theater history and at least one epic, you know, legendary performance. Uta Hagen as Martha just really went down in the history books, I guess, as soon as it happened, and remains just a touchstone of the American theater.
So yeah, that's a lot of homework. But with all the snow that we've been having recently, it's a good time to stay in and listen to that stuff, huh?
I know it gave me a chance to catch up on a lot of stuff. So that was the upside of all that snow.
You also returned to Glass Menagerie one last time before it closed on February 23rd. So tell us what has changed, or is it still the same?
Oh well, you know it remains one of the most beautiful productions of any play that I've ever seen. It is interesting. I will say, having seen it three times, I saw it at ART up in Cambridge before it transferred to Broadway. Then I saw it right at the beginning of the Broadway run. And then I saw it a week before it closed. And it's so interesting to see, because I don't normally see shows more than once. And certainly not with the same cast. My impression was that the performances of Cherry Jones and Zachary Quinto as Amanda and Tom got larger and broader as the run went on, and not necessarily in a good way. It's so interesting. Cherry Jones gave an interview some time ago, I guess right before the Broadway opening, about how she felt she had never really 100% found the character of Amanda during the ART run, whereas I thought she was exquisite in that performance that I saw up there. She really recalibrated her performance, partly because I suppose the size of the theater, and it did get broader, stronger, and even louder on Broadway. And I know that some people reacted negatively to that because they felt that the character should not be that strong. I don't know if I agree with that, but that was a change I noticed in her performance. Zachary Quinto, I think, maybe upped the gay quotient in playing Tennessee Williams, who of course actually was gay. But that's something I noticed in him. Brian J. Smith, though, I have to say he was very good in Cambridge, but I think he improved greatly to the point where he gave a really superb, almost definitive performance in The Gentleman Caller by the time the show opened on Broadway. So I think that deserves really great praise when someone can improve their performance over the run of a show. I think that's really fantastic. And Celia Keenan-Bolger as Laura, I have to say, was brilliant from the first performance I saw to the last, just like a really rock as the center of the performance of this amazing play in a character who is, you know, so difficult to play because she's so inward and pathologically shy. Celia was just wonderful and absolutely perfect, and I think that I hope all of these people get full recognition for their work at come awards time, because they all deserve it. It really was superb.
So it has closed on February 23rd, as I mentioned before, as I mentioned a few months ago when I saw it, that I agree with everything that you said there, Michael. It was a production that was definitive, in my opinion. I hope that it has been recorded and will at least be at the Lincoln Center archives.
Yeah, I know for a fact that it has. I just assumed it would be. I believe all shows are now, except all Broadway shows, except in very rare instances. Mm-hmm. But Celia confirmed that it was. It would have been, I think it would have been really amazing to put it on PBS or something like that, or one of these cinecasts.
Yeah.
But we don't have that, but you can at some point in the future go to Lincoln Center and tell them you want to see it, and then they'll let you see it.
All right. So next up, we have Maud Margaret at Cafe Carlyle. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I had a really great week, James, like you. I've been seeing a lot of excellent stuff lately. And Maud Maggart is one of our finest singers who I guess I haven't seen her or heard her much recently in New York. I hope she performs regularly elsewhere. I think she does. And she's a beautiful girl, young woman, I should say, who has a very extraordinary, unique voice that is very much of another time. And she exploits that a lot in singing songs by Gershwin and Porter and really wonderful old standards. Over the Rainbow was in her show at the Cafe Carlyle. And a lot of people can't, you know, it's hard to get away with Over the Rainbow. But as I say, her sound is so unique that really helps her to put her own spin on things. So I was very glad to see and hear her again. She is the daughter of Brandon Maggart, who musical theater fans will know his name from the original cast of Applause. And she is also the sister of Fiona Apple. So talent definitely runs in that family. And keep your eye out for her, or at least get one of her albums and see what all the fuss is about, because it's hard to, I won't even attempt to describe her voice, because it's hard to do so. It has something of a little girl wistful quality to it. That's as close as I can get. But she's a great stylist, and she really plays the lyrics. And I hadn't been to the Carlyle in really quite some time, and it was nice for me to go back on the occasion of her debut there. It was a really special occasion. And then just last night, I just wanted to tell you briefly, I saw an evening of Jerry Herman with the Fred Barton Orchestra down at Pace University in the Michael Schimmel Center for the Arts, not to be confused with the Skirball or the Kimmel. I always have to stop myself before I say these theater names. But I don't even know if I've ever been in this space before, but it was wonderful. It was only it was very wide and curved seating area, only maybe about 12 rows deep, I think, and then a similarly shallow mezzanine, and a very large stage that all of the 13 musicians were on, conducted by Fred Barton, and he did all new arrangements for all of these Jerry Herman songs, from the most famous ones you could name to really many obscure ones, including three songs that were cut from Hello, Dolly. At one point, Clea Blackhurst sang the two songs that were written for the show when Ethel Merman was originally, it was hoped that Ethel Merman would create the role. And of course it went to Carol Channing, and Ethel Merman didn't do it till years later, the end of the run. And those two songs were put back in for her. One is called World Take Me Back, and the other is called Love Look in My Window. And then Leroy Reams, who has a very long association with Hello, Dolly, did Penny in My Pocket, which is a really delightful song that Vandergelder was supposed to sing, but that was cut, I think, early. I think I'm not even sure it ever made it into any version of the show, even out of town. So those two amazing people were in it. Also, we had Beth Level, whom I just adore her. She is so great. Jeffrey Denman, Damon Kirsch, Tari Kelly, Karen Murphy doing an amazing knockout version of If He Walked Into My Life, and Tony DiBuono, the Forbidden Broadway veteran. She and Beth did Bosom Buddies, and then an entire male troupe of dancers, the Scott Thompson dancers, who really worked their butts off in several numbers. It was incredible how well rehearsed this one night event was. And then three young, really new young people who you're going to be hearing more about: Leanne Marie Dobbs, AJ Hunsicker, and Jesse Luttrell. So thanks for Fred Barton. Thanks to Fred Barton for doing this. I know he's done a couple of these before. It's called American Showstoppers. That's the name of the series. I know he's done them before, but this is the first one I got to. And pace is not, you know, is not normally a well-traveled area for me, downtown Manhattan like that. So it actually took me a while to figure out how to get there. But once I did, it was really quite easy. Lots of trains go there. And so keep them on your radar, really. It was so worth it. And Jerry Herman, just one showstopper after another.
So, yeah, those are great. I have links to this that information in the show notes. I just wanted to go back to the Cafe Carlyle for a second because Maud just finished up March 1st. Next up on the docket there, Shirley Jones.
Yes.
March 4th through the 15th. John Pizzarelli, otherwise known as Mr. Jessica Mulaski, is on March 18th to the 29th. Alexa Ray Joel, Billy Joel's daughter. Lucy Arnaz, Tommy Tune, Steve Tyrell. So all this stuff is happening through May coming up, and I'll have a link to that as well. It's pretty pricey, but some top-of-the-line talent happening there. And
yes, and I'm told...
beautiful room.
You can sit at the bar for you know, considerably less. And the bar seating is perfect in terms of sight lines. So if that's a possibility for you, consider that.
Excellent. So that kind of wraps it up for this week. Michael, anything you want to throw in before we go?
I don't think so. Just still, you know, so much coming up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Sweeney Todd, I believe, is Wednesday through Saturday or Sunday. So you have several chances to see that. And that's a pretty large theater. So, but I hear it's sold quite well, as you might imagine, with Bryn Terfel and Emma Thompson and Aaron Mackey and Philip Quast and J. Armstrong Johnson. But check it out. You know, maybe you can get a ticket to that.
Absolutely. quickly, in the news was announced that tomorrow, Monday, the 3rd of March, the Bridges of Madison County are going into the studio to record on Shikaboom, I believe it is. So we're looking forward to that as well. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You don't have to listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us through an application like Stitcher. Stitcher is an application that runs on your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. I want to put out a notice to our listeners that if you would like to join us and listen to our production live in the morning, please go to BroadwayRadio.com and send me an email, and I will invite you to that. It's something that I'd like to start testing out to have folks listen to us live. And if you want to be in on that, you know, a handful of people at first, just to see how it goes, please email me. And all the contact information for Peter, Michael, and me is at BroadwayRadio.com. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, who will be back next week, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Past the thinking, past the breathing, past the beating of my heart. It will all fade away, but you, it all fades away, it all fades away, it all fades away, but you, it all. But you, but you.